Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Anna Mateo. Later, we will bring you our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, prayer flags fly high in the wind across steep valleys and roads in the Kingdom of Bhutan. Many visitors remember seeing Bhutan's Buddhist religious centers and stately-looking defenses called zongs. Others might recall large water-powered prayer wheels spinning near waterfalls, or farmers watching over long-haired yaks in the countryside. Bhutan is the last remaining Buddhist kingdom in the Himalayas. The country lies between India and China, but it has never been captured or colonized. Bhutan still has much of its ancient culture, but it is attempting to become more modern without sacrificing its independence, culture, or natural environment. Bhutan advertises itself as an exclusive place to visit through high-value, low-impact tourism. Foreign visitors usually travel there by way of India or other nearby countries. Tourists can only visit Bhutan by signing up with licensed tour operators. In the 1970s, the fourth king of Bhutan proposed an unusual method for measuring the country's success. Unlike traditional measures, like the gross domestic product, the king suggested what he called gross national happiness. Gross national happiness means efforts in support of sustainable development, education and health, and valuing societal good over economic growth. The smoking of cigarettes is banned in the kingdom. In addition, Bhutan is the world's only carbon-negative country. That means it produces less carbon than its forests and other plants take in. In 2016, the fifth and current king created the Laya Royal Highlander Festival, an event designed to bring tourists. The celebration takes place in October. It includes events like yak judging, wrestling competitions, pony races, and native dancing. Tourists attending the Highland Festival have to travel a total of 58 kilometers from a height of 1,830 meters to more than 3,800 meters above sea level. Many paths along the way are rocky. Tour groups use donkeys to carry fuel, tents, and other supplies. Rain can make those trails dangerous for both the animals and festival goers. But the difficult conditions did not stop Bhutan's king from attending the event last October. He made the trip in only a few hours. Most tourists, however, complete the trip in 2 days. Festival organizers covered a tent with gold and set up a throne-like chair for the king. But he spent most of his time greeting people. Before the start of the pony race, food was served. Hundreds of villagers and visitors sat cross-legged as helpers served rice, vegetable curries, and hot butter tea. All of the food was provided by the king, and everyone seemed very happy.
As a language learner, what is one thing you wish you had more of a chance to do? For many, the answer is having people around to practice with in the target language. One club in Washington, D.C. is offering language learners a chance to do just that. Conversational D.C. plans informal free events in 7 languages. The gatherings take place at Washington area cafes or bars. Participants buy a drink and practice the language as much as they can. Speaking English is discouraged. Lauren Aitken started Conversational DC last year. She describes it as a language immersion social club. The club welcomes learners of all levels. Some are just beginning their studies. Others are already fluent speakers of the language. They can wear stickers that say facilitator. They are there to answer questions and help guide conversations if needed. Aitken described Washington as the perfect city for a club like Conversational DC. In America's capital, many people are learning one or more new languages, either for work or just for fun.
I think DC is a place that attracts people that are curious about the world. Because of that, I think it's one of these perfect cities for something like this, where it requires you to get out of your comfort zone a little bit and take a chance by speaking in another language.
Conversational DC has held more than 30 events in 7 languages, including French, Spanish, and Arabic. Spanish is its most popular language, Aitken said. Its newest language? Japanese. VOA Learning English intern Ray Goto is an international student from Japan. Last month, he attended the club's first ever Japanese event. Like many Conversational DC events, it took place at Colony Club, a bar and coffee shop in DC's Parkview neighborhood. Goto spoke with DC area Japanese learners and speakers. Steve Pelkovitz attended the Japanese event. He is an alum of the Japanese Exchange and Teaching Program, or JET. The JET Alumni Association sponsored the Conversational DC event. Pelkovitz has lived in Japan 2 times. He first became interested in the language through Japanese video games when he was young. He decided to begin studying Japanese with a tutor. Pelkovitz is now a graduate student living in DC. He says he does not get that many chances to practice or use his Japanese. He plans to return to Japan this summer. In Japanese, he told Goto, "I will move back to Japan next summer to work, so I want to practice speaking Japanese before moving back." Aitken says she hopes the club will have another Japanese event in the future. And she says the club will continue to add new languages, including Mandarin Chinese and Russian. Aitken added, "I love languages. I love their abilities to connect people across cultures and connect people around the world."
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Seaweed describes plants and algae that grow in oceans, lakes, rivers, and other bodies of water. Some kinds of seaweed are too small to see. They float in the water and are the food base for most ocean life. Other kinds are huge, such as giant kelp. Their roots grow from the floors of lakes, rivers, and oceans. Medium-sized seaweeds wash up on beaches and shorelines all around the world. They are colored red, green, black, and brown. The most common kind of seaweed that we eat is brown, such as kelp and wakame, and red, such as nori. Nori is the seaweed used to make sushi, the popular Japanese food. In fact, many people may think of seaweed as an Asian food product. After all, China, South Korea, Japan, Indonesia, and the Philippines are among the largest producers of seaweed. However, seaweed grows all over the world, and people worldwide eat seaweed. Norway, Chile, France, and the United Kingdom are also major producers of seaweed. Scandinavians add seaweed to soup and salads. In Ireland, people have been eating seaweed for hundreds of years. It helped Irish people survive a severe lack of food in the country during the 1800s. The Scottish culture has also eaten seaweed for many, many years. And records show that ancient Romans used seaweed to treat wounds, burns, and rashes. Now, the taste of seaweed may not be for everyone. Naturally, it can taste fishy. For those who do not like the taste of seaweed, dried and powdered seaweed can be added to foods without changing the flavor. And researchers at Oregon State University have developed a seaweed that tastes like bacon when fried. That is good news for vegetarians. Also good news for people who don't eat meat is that many types of seaweed, especially those colored red, are high in protein. Besides being a non-meat source of protein, seaweed can provide other health benefits. Several nutrition websites say that women in South Korea often drink seaweed soup after giving birth. It is thought to help to return nutrients and minerals to new mothers. But this simple soup is good for anyone. The health and nutrition website, Mark's Daily Apple, gives one recipe for this easy-to-make soup. Cook wakame seaweed, mushrooms, sesame oil, garlic, and tamari seasoning in a pot of water over a low temperature. Nutritionists at the University of California, Berkeley, say seaweed is a rich source of several minerals, including calcium, magnesium, potassium, copper, and iron. A report on the Berkeley Wellness website lists many reasons to eat seaweed. For example, seaweed, especially the brown type, is high in iodine. Iodine is a necessary element for good health, but it is not found in most foods. Iodine helps keep the body's thyroid gland healthy, among other things. Iodine levels differ greatly among different kinds of seaweed. One source says that brown seaweed can contain 5 to 50 times the amount a body needs. The amount of iodine depends on the water in which the seaweed grows. If you are on a low iodine diet, health experts suggest talking to your doctor before eating seaweed. Seaweeds are also a good source of soluble fiber. This type of fiber helps you to feel full. It also helps to lower the amount of bad cholesterol. One kind of seaweed may help to limit the body's absorption of fat. Researchers at Britain's Newcastle University studied alginate, a seaweed used in food and cloth production. The scientists say they found that dietary fiber in alginate could reduce the amount of fat absorption by around 75%. Despite all of these health benefits, some health experts warn that the benefits of seaweed are exaggerated. For example, seaweed may contain vitamins A and C, as well as calcium, but you would need to eat a lot of seaweed to get enough of any of those. In other words, seaweeds should not be your only source of vitamins and minerals. Nutritionists also warn that seaweed can block B12 vitamins. So if you eat a lot of seaweed, they suggest taking a B12 supplement. And before you eat seaweed, know where it comes from. Seaweeds easily absorb and store whatever is in the water in which it grows. Possible dangers include arsenic, mercury, and other heavy metals. So, seaweed can be a healthy vegetarian addition to your diet. Just get it from a clean water source and understand its limits and benefits. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. America's Civil War in the 1860s did not have the full support of the people. Many said they did not care who won, North or South. They just wanted to be left alone. In the North, many young men refused to be drafted into the Union Army. Some of their protests turned violent. Southern leaders were pleased with the anti-war movement in the North. Confederate General Robert E. Lee saw it as a sign of weakness in the Northern war effort. He also saw it as an opening for a military victory. Lee hoped for a final, decisive blow that would bring the war to an end. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe talk about General Lee's campaign north to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Gettysburg was a small town. Many roads came together there. Robert E. Lee needed those roads to pull his army together quickly. He had 70,000 men in all, but they were spread over a wide area of southern Pennsylvania. Some were at York to the east. Some were at Carlisle to the north, and most were at Chambersburg to the west. All of them were ordered to move against the Union force at Gettysburg. General Robert E. Lee had not planned to go to Gettysburg. He had planned to capture Harrisburg, the state capital, and then Philadelphia. If successful, he would turn south to seize Baltimore and Washington. Lee had not worried about the large Union Army of the Potomac. He believed it was far behind him in Virginia. But Lee was wrong. The Union Army had followed him, and it had reached Gettysburg first.
The first group of Northern soldiers formed a thin line of defense outside Gettysburg. The first group of Southern soldiers attacked this line. It was the morning of July 1st,
1863. When the guns began to roar, both sides hurried more men to the front. After hours of fighting, the Confederates had pushed the Union soldiers back through the town. The Union soldiers formed a new line along a place called Cemetery Hill. General Robert E. Lee decided not to attack the hill immediately. He would wait for more men. But as he waited, more and more Union soldiers arrived. By sunrise the next day, Lee's 70,000 men faced a Union army of 90,000 men.
The Confederates attacked both sides of the Union line. They moved the Union soldiers a little, but then the Union soldiers came back again. The Confederates could not hold the line. The fighting stopped at sunset. Union Commander George Meade met with his generals. He said he was sure General Lee would attack again the next day. The next attack, Meade said, would be against the center of the Union line. Meade was right. Lee planned to send 15,000 men against the Union center. They would be under the command of General George Pickett.
When the sun rose on July 3rd, the Union troops were ready. They watched as the Confederate troops set up their cannon. More than 130 of these big guns were aimed at the center of the Union line. The morning passed. The day grew hotter. A little past 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a Confederate gun fired once, then again. That was the signal to attack. All at once, the Confederate artillery thundered with a deafening roar. The cannon sent iron and smoke into the Union soldiers on Cemetery Hill. Within minutes, hundreds lay dead or dying. Union artillery on the hill answered the Confederate cannon. Men lay flat on the ground. They prayed for the shelling to stop. Finally, it did, and the smoke of battle began to clear.
Now the Union soldiers could see across the valley. They watched as the Confederate soldiers formed a long line. It was a sight to take your breath away. Facing Cemetery Hill, the Confederates stood shoulder to shoulder in a line almost 2 kilometers long. Sunlight shone from their guns. Their battle flags waved. Slowly, the line began to move. It seemed more like a parade than an attack. Shouts went up and down the Union line. Here they come. Here come the rebels.
Thousands of Confederate soldiers moved across the valley outside Gettysburg. Union artillery opened fire. The guns tore open big holes in the Confederate battle line. But the Southerners kept moving forward up the hill. Union soldiers rose up from behind stone walls and fallen trees. They poured even more gunfire into the Confederate line. More and more bodies fell to the ground. Still, the line moved forward. A few Confederates reached the Union line, but not enough to seize it. They were shot down. Suddenly, the Confederates began racing down the hill. Many raised their hands in surrender. 15,000 began the attack. Only half returned. The Battle of Gettysburg was over. The Union commander, General Meade, was told that the Confederate attack had been broken. He said simply, "Thank God." The Confederate commander, General Lee, said, "This has been a sad day for us. A sad day."
Lee's invasion of the North had failed. There was only one thing he could do now, retreat. He must get his army back to Virginia. He could only hope that the Union army was hurt too badly to chase him. The line of wagons carrying wounded soldiers was 25 kilometers long. Many of the wounded needed treatment, but the wagons were not permitted to stop for any reason. Suffering was terrible. An officer who led the wagon train said he learned more about the horrors of war on that one trip than he had learned in all of his battles. 20,000 Confederate soldiers were killed, wounded, or listed as missing in the Battle of Gettysburg. 23,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing.
General Meade lost so many men that he was in no hurry to chase General Lee. He believed it might be best to let Lee escape than to take a chance on losing what remained of the Army of the Potomac. Meade waited for a week until his army was stronger, but by then Lee and his men had crossed safely back into Virginia. President Abraham Lincoln was angry. He had told General Meade that driving the Confederates out of the North was not enough. The Southern Army must be destroyed. "We had them," Lincoln said. "We had only to stretch out our hands and take them. And nothing I could do or say could make the army move."
President Lincoln believed that General Meade had made a mistake, but he felt that the general had ability. Lincoln was thankful for what Meade had done at Gettysburg. He said Meade would continue to command the Army of the Potomac. In November of 1863, President Lincoln went to Gettysburg. He attended the opening of a new burial place for the Union soldiers who had died in the great battle there.
The governor of Pennsylvania had asked the president to say a few words at the ceremony. Lincoln agreed. He felt it was his duty to go, to honor the brave men who lost their lives to save the Union. Lincoln hoped his words might help lift the spirit of the nation. Lincoln did not have much time to prepare his speech. He wrote it down the night before the ceremony. Lincoln was sure the speech was not a good one, but it came to be one of the most famous speeches in American history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.